are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, November 8th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Joseph Cerencioni, he's the president of the Plowshares Fund. We're talking about Donald Trump's threats to pull out of a vital arms control treaty. Has Russia already been violating the very same terms of that same treaty? The Iran deal, gutted, but maybe still in effect for most of the world. And the future of making sure that we don't destroy humankind. Jeff Sessions is out. Don't forget that his greatest policy legacy is torturing children. But Donald Trump may have found his Roy Cohn after all, and certainly a guy whose business instincts he can respect, with a new acting attorney general, Whitaker, apparently implicated in a massive swindle in Florida. Sounds like a perfect Trump appointee. Ruth Bader Ginsburg wishing her a speedy return to full health with three fractured ribs. Wishing her all the best and wishing maybe that she had let Obama fill her seat. But also recognizing that none of this will matter if we don't introduce term limits and court packing. DSA and other progressive left causes and candidates fared well down ballot across the country and in key ballot initiatives, including expanding Medicaid in Idaho. 12 killed at a bar shooting in Ventura, California. Donald Trump and his administration revoking Jim Acosta's press pass. And there might be a little bit of fake news involved in this revoking. Jair Bolsonaro announces that he will be increasing the salaries of the Supreme Court justices and other justices who put the man who would have beat him, Lula da Silva, in prison, even as the same U.S.-backed prosecutor who waged a vendetta against Lula and the Workers' Party is now ignoring corruption in Bolsonaro's circles and taking a job in the fascist administration as justice minister. Justin Trudeau, while acknowledging Canada's past crimes towards the Jewish people, makes a ridiculous attack on those working for rights and justice for all in the Middle East. And why is it that Benjamin Netanyahu is so cozy with the global far right but loathes the EU? That is a rhetorical question. All that, plus there are ballots. What was that? Oh, go for it. Sure.
Ballots. So-called progressives are actually regressive.
There's still ballots to be counted in Florida and Georgia. It's a big uphill battle, but I love it. They're going to a runoff. Never concede.
December 4th, I believe, right?
I believe it's December 4th. And we should not treat that election as legitimate with Brian Kemp's mass voter suppression.
And Kemp has now resigned as a Secretary of State.
Right. Good time before all the court cases piling up for his suppression and theft of the election for him to bow out. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Yesterday, we played a clip of Donald Trump freaking out at Jim Acosta. Donald Trump is usually pretty good at these things because he's a decent lounge comic, but yesterday he clearly was having sort of rage, anxiety, would you call it? On one hand, saying he was looking forward to work with the Democrats and with Nancy, and oh, it would be so great to be bipartisan, but on the other hand, being like, yo, do not look into my finances. I mean, one can imagine.
It's a hoax.
It's a total hoax. I mean, could you imagine, even if somehow it came up that there was nothing to the Russia story. And there's something to it, I don't doubt, although obviously it's been overinflated by resistance types, but there's something to it. But just the idea that you have a team of financial crimes investigators combing through Donald Trump's businesses, I mean, the amount of criminal activity that they're probably running across, from like, you know, petty scams to connections with like organized crime figures from everywhere.
Real estate's a very clean industry.
Right. Real estate, casinos, and Trump. No crimes there.
No crimes.
No crimes. Oh,
fake news.
Nope. Fake news.
Fake justice, folks.
Fake justice, fake crimes. No fake crimes, no peace. So he's freaking out, and things came to a head with Jim Acosta, and they've revoked Jim Acosta's press credentials. And let's watch this. They're saying it's because Jim Acosta assaulted, physically attacked a White House intern who attempted to retrieve his microphone from him. We're going to watch this exchange, and this, at least from this angle, this reminds me of the infamous Maxine Waters assaulted me incident. Let's take a look.
If I may ask, Peter, one other question, are you worried?
That's enough. That's enough.
Mr. President, I was going to ask one of the other folks.
That's enough.
Pardon me, ma'am. Mr. President.
That's enough.
Mr. President, I had one other question, if I may ask, on the Russian.
Okay, so basically it looks like she's, the intern's actually pretty aggressively moving to take his mic.
Yeah, the intern scored well on the authoritarian, following orders thing. Because I just want to point one thing. Just look at the way she looks at Trump here. Like, can you make him give me the microphone? It just looks gross.
Very creepy and very servile.
That's enough.
I was going to ask one of the other folks.
That's enough.
Pardon me, ma'am. Mr. President.
That's enough.
Mr. President, yes. One other question, if I may.
That's
bizarre. So creepy.
That is so creepy. And also it even shows that she even has some sense of fear. Like, she's just an intern.
She knows she's doing something wrong.
She knows she's doing something wrong, but she also knows that he might blow up and freak out on her even. And, you know, so she's put, I mean, no sympathy for her, but I don't really have any, I mean, but she's in an impossible situation. I mean, the president of the United States is asking an intern to actively suppress the press.
You know what I would do? I would not consider that an impossible situation. I would consider that a meal ticket, and I would resign.
Right, I would say, right, exactly. No, Mr. President, I will not be a brown shirt for you. And then she would get booked on every single talk show on the planet, and probably could actually write a pretty funny White House memoir. I'm sure even interns have endless numbers of anecdotes about the stupidity, grotesqueness, and nonsense of this administration. Now, we make a lot about the racism of the Republican Party, but there are two people that, if we're being intellectually honest, who are African-American. They're women, in fact, and they have a strong influence on Donald Trump and the Republican Party, and that is, of course, the crucial political analysts, the duo known as Diamond and Silk. They're not only political analysts, they're also recording artists. They're respected rappers contributors regularly on all Fox properties. And they had some thoughts for Lou Dobbs, which, of course, was, I'm sure, getting funneled directly back to the White House while Donald Trump anxiously slurped a milkshake. Sorry for the disgusting image. It could have been worse.
Well, yeah, it's time for Acosta, for his press credentials to be removed.
Yeah.
It's very sad that he don't understand, as a journalist, he is supposed to report news, not make the news and not be the news. And yes, he is the enemy of the people. Not only that, but the enemy of the truth. He's very disrespectful, very disparaging. And you know what? Why is he even in there? He don't even need to go to the White House anymore and report anything, because we don't even want to hear it anymore.
Wow.
So 13 minutes after that aired, Acosta was notified that his credentials had been revoked.
So 13 minutes after the word came down from the Diamond and Silk High Command, Jim Acosta's press credentials were revoked in what is both a hilarious and ridiculous comedy and also an objective authoritarian attack on the free press. Right around the time, and I guess this was the time this was announced, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who every single journalist right now should be embarrassed if they defended her from some jokes a couple of months ago.
Smoky eye, unfair.
Yeah, unfair. Old Smoky Eye herself, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, tweeted out this video of Trump, Acosta, and the intern. Now, we played you the original video, but is there something we missed here? Because look, obviously, if Jim Acosta hit an intern, we would be the first ones to say, yeah, you actually can't do that. So let's check out this video. And is this either still the Maxine Waters incident? Is this Gianforte or Maxine Waters? Well, we have a second video. Let's check it out. It's up on screen now. And
I mean, it doesn't look a whole lot different, but
it looks like
they've isolated the karate chop here.
They isolated. So what they've done is they've slowed this down. And what they should have done is they should have put like a Bruce Lee sound effect over it. And he would have been like, "Hoya! Hadouken!" And so to make it look, because basically what really happened, you could see, is she's actually going after him and trying to rip his mic out of his hand, which, if we're being, you know, pedantic here, that is where, you know, the actual assault or whatever takes place. So obviously there was no assault or really the physical part of this is nothing. The part of this is the president and intern trying to literally rip a mic out of a reporter's hands because the president's having an authoritarian
tantrum.
You can mute
the microphone. These are electronic things. These aren't analog devices.
This is true. The microphone can be muted. So, but what they've done,
Rafael Shimunov on Twitter posted this video where he overlaid the original C-SPAN clip with the one that was tweeted out by Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the press secretary of the United States of America. And it turns out that there was some clever fast-forwarding and slow-moing, very subtle, to make it look like the chop was more aggressive.
Like he was kind of hitting her aggressively, like, "Hey, get out of my face."
Yeah, so here it is. I'll just scrub over this, and you can kind of see there's a transparent overlay, so the red, you can see the difference between the two clips there.
Can you guys see that? So in the real one, it's just sort of like a natural motion. He's actually pointing his finger at Trump to say something, and their arms brush together. And then they fast forward it to look like he was actually chopping down on her arm, which actually, it's funny. He wasn't even doing that minorly.
No.
Like, that just literally wasn't happening.
He was maybe reacting to the fact that, like, an arm was reaching across where he was gesturing, right?
Right,
like,
right.
And then immediately after, in the original clip, he's like, "Pardon me, ma'am, I'm trying to ask a question." He wasn't chopping. It wasn't Bruce Lee.
He was not Bruce Lee-ing an intern. So where did this sped-up fake video, by the way, very subtle and well done, where did this video come from that Sarah Sanders, old Smokey Eye herself, tweeted out? Oh, my God. Soy phobic health expert Paul Joseph Watson, the depressed, beleaguered British arm of Alex Jones's InfoWars.
Imagine my shock.
Well, Paul Joseph Watson has spoken multiple times for all of us this morning. Imagine our shock. So just to make this very clear and put a button on it, the president had a tantrum over a question. An intern attempted to rip a mic out of a reporter's hand. The president continued his tantrum. Then a pair of internet personalities went on Fox Business and said, "This journalist should have his credentials pulled." 13 minutes later, the White House press secretary announced that his credentials would be pulled and tweeted out a fake video by a doctored video by a alt-right extremist news outlet
that had been banned by Twitter.
That had been banned
partially by
YouTube and iTunes and several other platforms. So, yeah. Aces.
It's where we're at.
This is great. This is where we're at. And in a couple of minutes, I'm going to talk with Joseph Cerencioni about how this same administration might be working to dismantle the entire arms control infrastructure of the globe, which has managed to keep us from essentially eliminating the viability of life on planet Earth since the beginning of the Cold War. So, great stuff. Everybody, have a drink. Today's sponsor is NewsVoice.com. We all know that media conglomerates and concentrations of news are a danger to public discourse, and that people live in more and more epistemic bubbles. Even if you are focusing and want opinion and analysis, obviously, you still need a sort of broad sense of the political landscape so you can understand the opposition. You can understand how people think, and you also can support your arguments across the board with the best empirical evidence available. There's a news company that has come up with its own response to these problems. It's called News Voice. It's an app for iOS and Android, which you can access for free if you go to newsvoice.com/majority, and it gives you a personalized news feed by aggregating a mix of mainstream media sources, international sources, and independent media sources. Multiple sources are provided for each news story. The entire app is fueled by crowdsourcing. You can upvote stories you think are important so more people will see them. You can add stories to the app, or you can add a source that's missing for a story. It's meant to be completely open and democratized news aggregator that lets you get every side of every story. They also have a video interview series featuring guests from Chris Hedges to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Go down the app for free at newsvoice.com/majority, and we've put a link to it under this video if you're watching on YouTube. We're going to take a brief break, and we will be right back with Joseph Cerencioni. He's the president of the Plowshares Fund. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Joseph Cerencioni. He is the president of the Plowshares Fund. Joseph, thanks so much for doing this.
It's my pleasure, Michael.
So, Joseph, before we get to some of the specifics of what President Trump has indicated he might do with regards to intermediate missile treaty, can you sort of reset everything for us? What is the global infrastructure of arms control agreements? Both, maybe you could give us just a sort of overview, including bilateral agreements between the United States and Russia, and also international agreements that many countries are still signed on to. What is this sort of basis upon which we've built a world where, you know, miraculously these things have not been used since the atrocities in Japan.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. You know, I teach a course at Georgetown University Graduate School, so I have an hour and a half lecture on exactly this topic. How much time do we have?
That's great. I'll sit back. I'll go grab my coffee and listen to my headphones.
We can do this real quick. I mean, it's, you know, the basic themes are pretty simple. You know, ever since the first atomic bomb in Hiroshima, there's been two impulses in the world, and one is we got to get rid of these things, and the other is we got to get some of these things, and those two trends have really weaved in and out globally and nationally, and sometimes one trend dominates and sometimes the other. And the efforts to control the bomb started even before the bomb was exploded. Some of the scientists who were involved in the building of the bomb realized we need a system of controls, or this could destroy humanity. And various presidents took various steps on this. I think the most significant step that most people think is John F. Kennedy, where he negotiated with the Soviets in the early 60s to have a limited test ban treaty in response to massive worldwide pressure to stop the atmospheric testing of nuclear bombs, which were spreading radioactivity around the world and was showing up in mother's milk. It was showing up in cow's milk. It was showing up in babies' teeth. So that stopped the atmospheric testing mostly, though the underground testing continued. And then it was really Richard Nixon with Henry Kissinger who forged the first limits on nuclear weapons back in 1972, the Strategic Arms Limitation Talks, they were called, SALT. And then Ronald Reagan comes along, and he has, with this treaty, the one we're talking about, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, referring to missiles that fly in between very short ranges that you would use on a battlefield and the ocean-spanning ranges of our intercontinental ballistic missiles. These are medium and intermediate range missiles. And he reached a deal with Mikhail Gorbachev in 1987 to eliminate those, that the United States and the Soviet Union would take the some 3,000 weapons they had built, perfectly beautiful, modern, working missiles, and would destroy them. And over the next few years, they destroyed all 3,000 of them and pledged not to build any in their arsenals to avoid this risk of a regional conflict becoming quickly a nuclear conflict, which would then spread to a global war.
Two more.
And that was the first time we actually reduced the weapons rather than just limited them. What was that?
I want to give you two more historical questions, one on the negative horrifying and one positive. So I think people are familiar with the Cuban Missile Crisis. Could you give us a couple of examples and, you know, probably include the Cuban Missile Crisis because that's always worth retelling, of how close we've gotten to either an intentional use or accidental use of these weapons? And then let's just start with that one first.
Sure. Well, I'll tell you what George Shultz, former Reagan Secretary of State, and Bill Perry, the former Clinton Secretary of Defense, say, that we got out of the high point of nuclear risk in the Cold War by sheer luck. That we came real close to doing this. The Cuban Missile Crisis, Robert F. Kennedy famously wrote in one of his memoirs in one of his essays, that he was on the lawn of the White House during that crisis and thought, this is the last time I'm going to see the sunrise. And we really thought it was going to happen. So that's the one people remember the most, where a decision away from nuclear war. But there's been about a dozen serious close calls as a result of a computer glitch. At one time, a training tape was inadvertently put into the computers at NORAD, our defense system, and we thought we were under attack, and they almost launched it because the big board lit up and they thought we're under attack. This kind of incident was recently portrayed in Madam Secretary, the CBS show. Their last episode of season 4 in May concluded with just such an accidental event. So it's been, we really dodged it, but the truth remains what Kennedy said at the UN in 19 1961, we're living under a nuclear sword of Damocles hanging by a slender thread, and we could have a nuclear holocaust by accident, miscalculation, or madness. So he said we have to eliminate these weapons before they eliminate us, and that's still the struggle we're faced. We've come way down. Since Reagan started the reduction process, the INF Treaty led to the next Reagan Treaty that George H.W. Bush got to finalize and sign, the Strategic Arms Reduction Talks, or START, which cut the U.S. and Soviet arsenals in half. Since then, we've climbed down by 85%. We've reduced the number of nuclear weapons in the world. Most of them are held by the United States and Russia, by 85%. So we're down to about just over 14,000 nuclear weapons. The trouble is that reduction process has stopped. It is, there are no talks going on. There are no further reductions going on. And there are leaders in almost all the countries who want to increase the arsenals, including here. John Bolton, our national security advisor, is a big advocate of ramping up nuclear weapons. And he's been against any reductions or control mechanisms for his entire career.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll get back to the sort of catastrophe of Bolton in a minute. On the positive side, and I guess you already outlined some of it, but maybe could you also touch on Reykjavik, and also in a post Cold War world. I mean, I know Barack Obama certainly, at least in speeches, outlined his vision of ridding the world of these weapons. What about the closest time? You know, the closest we've gotten, whether it's been through actual policy or even just national articulation of Reagan, Gorbachev, Obama, of people saying we need to get rid of these things as a global project.
Okay. So the closest we came is Reykjavik. And that's where, you know, I was working on the House Armed Services Committee at the time, and I thought Ronald Reagan was the devil. I was working for the Democrats. And he had a big arms buildup in his first administration. In his second administration, he had come face to face with the nuclear threat, and he said, we have to eliminate these things. I thought it was a joke. I thought it was a ruse. But no, he really wanted to do it. And when he got a chance to sit down with Mikhail Gorbachev in Reykjavik in 1986, they came inches away from a deal to eliminate all nuclear weapons, all of them. George Shultz was right there with him. He still tells the story. And it got hung up over a dispute over the Star Wars program, the anti-missile program that Reagan had started. Both sides made a mistake. They should have agreed to some restrictions on the program. Reagan didn't want to give it up. Mikhail Gorbachev thought he couldn't make a deal if he came back to his generals with an unrestricted anti-missile program. So the deal fell apart. But Reagan and Gorbachev kept up their partnership, and that's what led to the INF Treaty in 87, and that's what led to the New START Treaty. So they didn't get all the way, but they started the reduction process. The second closest we've come is Barack Obama, who really came in, and I helped work on his campaign and helped work on the nuclear policy platforms. He really came in with the goal to institutionalize what Reagan had envisioned and thought he could do it and make a big start of it. And he did. His first couple of years were good. He had a new treaty, further reductions. He started a number of very positive initiatives, but he was met with the three R's. The Russians refused to cooperate. The Republicans attacked him ruthlessly. He made a big fight over simple treaties like the one he had on the New START Treaty. And then finally, he faced the resistance of the nuclear bureaucracy. And for them, it's all about contracts and jobs and keeping these programs alive. And his program petered out. But now, this is the exciting part. Here's the good news. We're going to have another shot at this. With the elections that have just happened, you're bringing into power Democrats like Representative Adam Smith, who will be most likely the new chair of the House Armed Services Committee, who think we're spending too much on nuclear weapons, who want to kill some of the more dangerous new programs that Trump is starting, like programs that would build new, more usable nuclear weapons for battlefield use, who thinks we have to change the policy of the United States, this is Adam Smith, so that the president can't just push the button and launch a war solely on his own decision. He wants to declare, change the policy so that we have what's called a no first use. The U.S. will not use nuclear weapons first. And with that, you get at least a couple of years where you can have these debates in the Congress, maybe enact some legislation, but really be the testing ground for the next set of nuclear policies that hopefully you can debate in the 2020 campaign and perhaps have a new president come in 2021 with a better plan than Obama had that accounts for the resistance you're likely to face, that can get us back to reductions and move us back on the path to elimination. And with that, this is the final thing I'll say, then I'll shut up. There is an international movement that has arisen against nuclear weapons, not as big as what we saw in the 80s when you had millions of people in the streets, but very significant. In fact, I was in Oslo, Norway last December to see the Nobel Peace Prize awarded to this group, International Campaign Against Nuclear Weapons, ICAN, who won the prize for their global campaign to get a new treaty that the UN has passed on banning nuclear weapons. First time in the nuclear age that we have a treaty banning them, saying they should be illegal. And this is picking up steam. They're hoping to have this treaty enter into force with they need 50 nations to ratify it. They hope that in 2019, no later than 2020, the treaty will actually enter into force. None of the states with nuclear weapons have signed it, but that's the struggle. See if you can pressure them into taking meaningful steps to reduce and ultimately ban these weapons.
So let's get to, you know, some of the nitty-gritty of this. The prime focus will be Trump and Russia, but I do want to touch on both. We'll get to North Korea and Iran, and then also some of the more, mm-hmm. you know, less prominent players that we talk about, the other states with this capacity, China, United Kingdom, and Pakistan, India, and France, but and Israel. But what is Trump's complaint about the intermediate missile treaty is that Russia has been violating it. And I have mm-hmm. to admit that I'm very used to, well, just basically disregarding what Trump says about things. But I've been reading that actually this isn't entirely not true, that right. Russia actually has been stepping outside the bounds of this treaty. And also, you, as you suggested earlier, that Russia was not as receptive as they might have been to President Obama's push to rid the world of these weapons and reduce arsenals, which is really in contrast to Putin's public branding. If you watch interviews with him, one of his complaints about the United States that I've seen is actually a lack of commitment to things like arms control. So he certainly mm-hmm. tried to position that he's sober and serious about these weapons. And maybe he's another person that we should be used to disregarding what he says as well. What's the actual truth of Russia and their relation to this treaty? And then, you know, is the answer, is that a viable play of, well, they're stepping out of it, so we'll just scrap the thing?
Yeah. So let me just let's unravel this. So the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, the INF Treaty, John Bolton has announced that they want to pull out of this. And Trump then made that statement at one of his political rallies a few weeks ago. We only have two remaining nuclear arms treaties with the Russians. One is this, the INF, and the other is the START Treaty. The START Treaty expires in 2021, and Bolton wants to kill that. So this is what's at stake. If you let that, the INF Treaty, he stabbed in the back. The new START Treaty, he wants to kill in its sleep, just not do anything and let it expire peacefully. You do that, then there's no more restraints, there's no more limits, there's no more inspections. One of the things that treaties give you is the ability to put your inspectors into their weapons sites so you can see what they're doing. That's why the military supports these kinds of agreements. It gives them transparency. It gives them predictability. It lets them plan more accurately. So there's general military support for these arms control agreements. Historically, it's been that way. It's been the ideologues who haven't liked them, not really the military. So will Putin go along with this? Well, you know, coming up very soon, November 11th, Putin and Trump are going to meet in Paris, and it's possible that Putin can pitch Trump to extend this treaty, can go over the head of Bolton, get right to the president, and might convince him to extend the treaty. Trump might be willing to do this. You can disagree with Trump on 9 out of 10 things, but every once in a while he is right. And mm-hmm. if you can mm-hmm. get him to do this, that would be a good thing. Are the Russians actually violating the INF? And again, Trump is right. Yes, they are. I was on the International Security Advisory Board for the Secretaries of State, Clinton and Kerry, and I saw the intel on this when it was coming in 2014, and it's pretty clear they are violating. It's a relatively small violation. It's not militarily significant. They've taken one of their short-range cruise missiles, one of the ones they launched from the ground, so a ground-launched cruise missile, and they've modified it so that it could have a greater range, a range that falls within the range prohibited by the treaty. So they are violating the treaty, and they deployed this at a test site in Russia and one other site, but in the Russian part of Europe, and it's just banned. You can't do it. You can't have a missile like this. Does it matter? Not really. The Russians have lots of other ways they can hit European targets, and we have lots of other ways that we can hit those targets with nuclear weapons. But it is technically a violation. Does Putin want to give up his nuclear weapons? No, I don't think he does. This is one of the last vestiges of superpower status that he has. Mm-hmm. So at this point, we're talking about getting these two autocratic leaders, somewhat irresponsible leaders, certainly undemocratic leaders, to just agree to the limits. Let's preserve the limitation and inspection regime so that we might have a shot at going back to reductions when we have more reasonable leaders in both countries.
So when we talk about a figure like John Bolton and this sort of broader neoconservative and far right opposition to these treaties, I mean, there's two components of it. They're both disturbing, but I think, and connected, but they are somewhat distinct. So one, I guess I understand just from that perspective ideologically, is just an opposition to any agreement to a restraint on U.S. force, period, as a principle
exactly
of U.S.
right.
Okay, go ahead.
No, that's yeah. exactly. You continue this. The idea is that, you know, we're the good guys, and we have hegemony over the world. We're the superpower. You know, who would you want to be the superpower? China? Mm-hmm. France? Mm-hmm. You know, we're the good guys, so we should have a certain amount of American exceptionalism. The rule shouldn't apply to us. We should be able to have the freedom to exercise our military force wherever we want, because we will only do that for good. And what we want is restraints on other people. And the liberals think that you get those restraints by mutual restraints, by treaties that mutually restrict both sides' military force, and the neoconservatives or the conservatives say, no, you only get those kinds of restrictions by force, by military dominance. And it has that view is particularly virulent and particularly sort of nationalistic right now in this administration. It really is, you know, America über alles. It's really above all. We set the rules, and if you don't go along with us, we will crush you one way or the other. You see that in the way they're treating Iran. You see that in the way they're trying to approach North Korea. You see it in their view of all international mechanisms, starting with the United Nations.
Definitely. And I want to touch on Iran and North Korea in a second. But the other thing that is incredibly disturbing, and obviously I reject every single piece of that view ideologically. But the other part that you read about and hear about is also the notion of developing, as you said earlier, battlefield deployable or smaller, nuclear weapons. How does that fit into it? And is this actually a legitimate thought process amongst these people that these things can be deployed in a more narrow way? Is this something they're really yeah. working on and want?
Yes, it is. And it comes directly from this view that, look, we have this military weapon. Why are we self-deterred from using it? Why do we hesitate to use nuclear weapons? And part of the reasoning is, according to this view, is that they're too big. You know, we now have bombs. Our basic bomb is approximately 10 times to 30 times the size of the Hiroshima bomb. So we no longer have atomic bombs. That's Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We have hydrogen bombs that basically duplicate the basic energy force in the universe, what powers the sun, fusion of atoms, not splitting of atoms. And those bombs, you know, are city destroyers. And so therefore, the logic goes, we need to make smaller bombs with back to Hiroshima size or smaller, so that we can use them on the battlefield and we can have an advantage And we can control the escalation. So if you go to the recent issue of Foreign Affairs, for example, the one of the preeminent American journals, you will see a discussion of nuclear weapons. And it's led off by an article that says we shouldn't be afraid of nuclear weapons anymore. And it's presented as new thinking by some of the new breed of young Dr. Strangelove that have emerged in this town.
Right.
No, really, right. They are out right there, and that you know them, and that's what they think.
Yeah.
You know, Elbridge Colby at the Center for New American Security, or Keir Lieber at Georgetown University. They're out there, and what they're doing is recycling theories from the 1950s. This is what military leaders thought and conservatives thought in the 1950s. Nuclear weapons are the weapons of the future. We need them for every mission. So we built not just nuclear missiles, not just nuclear bombs, but nuclear torpedoes, nuclear depth charges, nuclear landmines. My favorite weapon was a nuclear bazooka. We called it the Davy Crockett. Jesus. It fired a very small nuclear warhead about a half a mile. Now, why anyone would want to fire a nuclear weapon half a mile is beyond me. You know, and even the Army figured that out. We stopped making them in the 1960s. But we went nuclear nuts in the 50s, and we don't have those weapons anymore. We got rid of them, and the Russians got rid of them. And, you know, now you have a new class of these, as I say, young Dr. Strangeloves who want to bring them back and want to put them on ships and want to put them ground-launch cruise missiles, want new artillery pieces again. We used to have nuclear artillery. And they're presenting this as just part of the new great power struggle, and this is a weapon we should have. It was insane in the 50s. It's insane now.
I have to say, just the brief editorial here, the parallels across every single part of public discourse of ideas, right-wing ideas from the 50s and 60s getting recycled as fresh thinking now, it's amazing. It's everything from, like, gender relationships to nukes.
Yes.
It's kind of extraordinary.
To the John Birch Society.
To the John, right.
To American Nazis.
Right.
I mean, these kinds of ideas that America flirted with and rejected, well, they never went away.
Right.
And now they're back. And they're all being supported by this, well, I guess to be honest, this kind of white nationalist view,
right,
that cuts across all the issues areas, and this is how it's being expressed in the nuclear realm. It is not apart from the white nationalism. It is grounded in that worldview. Now, I'm not saying that the people who are proposing this would identify themselves as white nationalists. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying this is the same thinking. This is its ideological root. They have a shared worldview, and they have a shared aim, which is U.S., and what they generally mean by that is white U.S. global domination.
Well, we could paraphrase Andrew Gillum's, right? I'm not saying you do, but they think you are, right?
Oh, right.
I think that
all right, I'm not saying you're a racist,
yeah,
but they think you're
right,
a racist.
There you go. Yeah, well, same thing works.
I haven't heard this kind of, this is the first time I think I've discussed it like this, and the first time I haven't heard anybody else discussing like this, but I believe that this is true. I believe that's what's happening, and I don't believe you would be seeing these ideas giving this much prominence were it not for Donald Trump and Trumpism and the nationalist impulse it's riding.
Definitely. So let's touch then. I want to touch on North Korea and Iran. And, you know, my read is there is this very unconventional, bizarre dynamic between Trump and the North Korean leader, which is, you know, it's very funny to me in some ways. It's in a very, which I guess in my sort of cynical state, it's very entertaining. It's also very bizarre and very disturbing. And I will say, let's just take North Korea first. I see the dangers of it. I didn't like the sort of liberal opposition to them talking, though, frankly. I mean, I think it's absolutely better they're in communication than not communication. But
right.
I'm aware that obviously, you know, Trump is perfectly happy to go somewhere and sign a vision board without any kind of substance. So, you know, where are we at with North Korea?
Yeah.
And do you think it's better that they talk than not talk, just the sort of a general principle?
Yeah, so let's take this in three slices. You know, what's going on? What are the risks of what's going on? And if you're an observer or a progressive observer, what should you be thinking about it? And number one is, again, you have to give Donald Trump credit. After a first year where it was all fire and fury and Rocket Man, and we came real close to going to war with North Korea, and we certainly gave that impression. Remember a year and a half ago when Trump said he had an armada heading towards the Korean Peninsula? It turned out he didn't, but he thought he did, and he made us think he did. We were real close, and we were in that kind of situation where a mistake could have triggered a war. We've backed off from that. And since the beginning of the year, both, of course, the dictator in charge of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, and Donald Trump have ratcheted back and have shifted gears. And I think almost inadvertently, whether he's following his impulse or it's the way he sees the world, Trump may have stumbled onto a formula that can actually solve this North Korean problem. He flipped the script. Traditionally, the idea was you'd negotiate this complicated nuclear agreement, they'd all agree on it, and then we'd have a general peace treaty, and then you'd have a meeting between the two leaders. That was the prize at the end of the process. Well, he front-loaded it. And by giving Kim Jong-un the sort of security pledges, the sort of peace pledges, and the prestige of having a meeting with the president, he may have created the conditions that will actually allow North Korea to ratchet back their program. They've currently frozen much of it, but not all of it. And they've indicated that they're willing to do more. They're willing to take more steps. That's what's going on. And now it's in the balance. Can this process proceed or not? And North Korea is threatening to restart its program. They've suspended missile tests. They've blown up a test site. They say they're not going to test nuclear weapons anymore. They're still producing nuclear material, which is the next step. Can you get them to stop doing that and then roll it back? The problem you have may be the incompetence of this administration. It may be that they don't have the talented personnel to actually do it. God knows they haven't staffed the State Department. We're still missing key experts, key ambassadors. The Undersecretary for Asian Affairs, for example, is still not in place. There is none. No nomination.
There's no one from Duck Dynasty available?
That's right. Do we have any more friends?
Yeah, what's going on?
He can appoint anybody from the World Federation of Wrestlers, you know.
Right. I thought plenty of people were at Mar-a-Lago visiting. I don't understand why this is so hard to fill. Yeah.
Well, they're still not there, and that comes from from a megalomaniac view that you're the only important one, and the rest of these people are just getting in the way.
Right.
Can you do? And then you have the ideology of Bolton and Trump, who basically don't want to do this. They, especially Bolton, he's made a career of regime change. That the way you solve the problem is not to change the regime's behavior, but to change the regime. So he still wants to go with that, and they could sabotage the president's plans. That's actually what's happening right now. Right today, the day we're talking, the North Koreans have canceled a meeting of their foreign minister with the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, because they believe that Pompeo is not going to give them the goods. And that what they want is for Kim to meet again directly with Trump and have a personal exchange. And you know what?
Not a bad idea.
That's probably right.
Right.
They're probably right. So if Trump can just, at the moment, and I won't go into too much more detail than this, what the North Koreans want is a piece of paper. They want a pledge that the president declares the end of the Korean War, that which never ended. We just have a truce. It didn't formally end. And says we are at peace. And if you do that, they say they will start dismantling their facility that makes the stuff for the bombs. They will start dismantling their plutonium production facility. If you can trade paper for plutonium, I say you take that deal. It's not everything they have, and they still have other facilities enriching uranium, but it's a big start. It is a significant step. And if Trump and Kim can agree on that, that's a positive. So what should you think about this? If you're a progressive, you should be supporting this process. You should be putting aside your criticisms of Trump on other areas. You should be worried about the competence of the administration of doing this. You should be worried about whether Trump himself is capable of doing this. But you should support the diplomacy and hope it works. Because if it fails, well, the danger is then you're back to the threats and the recriminations and the jilted lovers. And anybody in a relationship like that knows it can get real ugly real quick.
Yeah. I mean, and also I would say I agree with that entirely. And I would just say, and also maybe you know, if you can comb around, look for somebody who might have recently been released from like Florida jail for like a health supplement scam or something like that, who maybe, you know, said something favorable about Trump, and we could staff up that Asian affairs portfolio you were talking about. But anybody, mail fraud? People?
Anybody? Yeah. Mueller?
Yeah. Anybody involved in, I would say, wire fraud and thinks Trump is great could probably do that and visited the Philippines once, would be a solid candidate for that portfolio.
And here's the one positive note on this.
Yeah.
Right now, the process is largely being driven by the Koreans themselves, both Kim Jong-un and by South Korean President Moon Jae-in.
Who's done very well in my read, yeah.
Who's kind of what?
Who's done very well in my read, yeah.
Oh, he has. He's driven the whole process. The Olympic truce was his idea. Getting the North Koreans to sit in the same booth as the Americans, Vice President Pence, you remember those famous photos. That was his idea. And they are moving, and they are de-escalating some of the conventional military conflict. In fact, he expressly says, we're going to take care of the conventional part. You guys take care of the nuclear part. So they now have regular hotlines, regular meetings. They've established a liaison office in the demilitarized zone where 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, North Koreans and South Korean military officers now talk to each other. They are demining a part of the demilitarized zone. They're actually starting to demilitarize the demilitarized zone. They're removing guard posts. They're banning military exercises within a 5-mile radius, so there's no mistakes that trigger a larger conflict. So the Koreans are moving ahead. They want the Americans to play a supporting role. And if Trump listens to Moon, I think we'll be okay.
Then so there's some grounds for optimism there. Iran, let's touch on Iran. I think Iran was, in my view, I mean, it's definitely one of the greatest accomplishments of the Obama administration. The deal, maybe you could reiterate, my read was undoubtedly working. Everybody was complying. And the rest of the world seems to want it, besides the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. So where are we?
Yeah. This was, the Europeans considered this the crowning achievement of European diplomacy. Remember, they'd been negotiating with the Iranians since 2003. And finally, they had a president, Obama, who was able to do it, and the political conditions allowed him to do it. So we joined these talks in 2013, and almost right away, we got a freeze on the program. A couple of months, bang, boom, done. And then we took another period of time, a little over a year, to get a final agreement that slashed the Iranian nuclear program to a fraction of its size, froze it for a good 15 years, and then put it under a strict inspection regime, under lock and seal. And these aren't, you know, Game of Thrones wax seals on parchment. These are real-time radio frequency fiber optic seals. You go into this room, you open this cask, you know, we're going to know immediately that you're violating the agreement. And because of all these arrangements and the 100-plus pages of detail into this agreement, the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, has certified, no, Iran is in compliance, and they've done that 12 times so far. Our own intelligence services, no, Iran is in compliance. They are not cheating. They are not building a bomb. They don't have any secret smuggling operations. No, this is locked down. We got a good 12 more years to go on this. And it's this deal that Trump decides is no good, that he wants to rip it up. So you don't actually rip it up. There's no withdrawal agreement. You violate it. He just stopped complying with it. And this month he imposed new sanctions, unilateral sanctions, saying that any country that does business with Iran, that, for example, buys Iranian oil, will be subject to sanctions. So we don't actually sanction Iran. We don't do business with Iran. We sanction friends and others who do business with Iran. So the Europeans, the Japanese, the Koreans, the Indians, the Chinese. Well, you can imagine how the rest of the world sees this. Here's the United States, who pulls out of this multinational agreement, an agreement endorsed, sanctioned by the United Nations Security Council. Every other country in the world likes this agreement, with the exception of Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. Everybody else likes it. It urges the president to stay in it. We pull out of it, and then we start imposing our own laws on them. So we are violating their right to set their own security priorities, their own security arrangements, by saying, no, we're going to decide for you. You, Europe, you can't trade with Iran. Bang, we're going to do that. Well, of course, this is the ultimate expression of American unilateralism. This is the ultimate expression of Trumpism. This is the Bolton ideal. We will force the world to do what we want. I would say that this approach has a near zero chance of working. The Washington Post, just today, the day we're talking, has editorialized on this. It's the Post is generally conservative on Iran, but they say, look, this embargo is going to be much less effective than what we put in within the Obama administration, when you had the whole world agreeing we shouldn't trade with Iran. What makes you think this is going to work? And the danger of it not working is that the pressure and the attempted isolation of Iran includes military pressure, and that increases the risk that there could be some incident, for example, involving U.S. forces in Syria, some 2,000, that might come in conflict with Iranian forces in Syria, some 10,000 Revolutionary Guard. And that spark, bang, that could lead to the bigger war that some actually want.
Right.
In Northeast Asia, none of our allies want to go to war with North Korea. Nobody thinks that's a good idea. In the Middle East, Saudi Arabia does think it's a good idea. The United Arab Emirates does think it's a good idea. Benjamin Netanyahu, not his military establishment, but Benjamin Netanyahu himself, thinks it's a good idea. We should push Iran back in the box, and military force is the way to do that. Economic isolation is just the beginning of the process. And so that's why the situation with Iran, with the flashpoints in Syria, the possible flashpoints in Yemen, is probably the most dangerous crisis we face right now. It's underreported. We're starting to get more discussion because of the brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi by the Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. Because of that, people are now reevaluating our support of the Saudi regime, reevaluating our support for the Saudis in Yemen, reevaluating our involvement in Yemen, and re-looking at the Iran-Saudi balance and saying, wait a minute, we don't want to get drawn into this. Why are we doing this again? Whose interest is this in? Is Saudi Arabia really much different than Iran? Is Iran really the source of world conflict in the region?
I would say objectively worse, right? I mean, not in any way to excuse the many, many failings and abuses of the Iranian leadership, but objectively worse with regards to democratic process and human rights. And I just don't even see how that's debatable.
I think we could settle on similar.
Yeah.
You know, both have throw political prisoners in jail.
Right.
Both have summary executions. Both oppress women. Both have supported groups that others see as terrorists. In the case of Iran, it's Hezbollah and Hamas. In the case of Saudi Arabia, for 40 years, they've been pushing a virulent form of Islam that gave rise to al-Qaeda and ISIS. And now they are engaged they are causing the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. The Saudi bombing of Yemen has killed or wounded tens of thousands of innocent Yemeni and has put 15 million people at risk of starvation and has led to the outbreak of cholera that's the worst since World War II. All this is not an accident. It's not caused by climate change. It's caused by Mohammed bin Salman's decision that he was going to reassert Saudi military might, and the way he was going to do that was intervening in the Yemen civil war. So, yeah, you it's real hard to look at that situation and believe Mike Pompeo when he comes out and announcing the embargoes and the sanctions that we're putting on people doing business with Iran, and says that they are the world sponsor of terrorism and they're the source of instability and in the Middle East, and it's their malign behavior. It's really hard to make that case anymore. And so we have the ray of hope I'll leave you and your listeners with is that we have a chance with the new Congress to push for a rebalancing of American interests in the Gulf, specifically by cutting off sales of U.S. weapons to the Saudis to stop them from bombing Yemen, to declare to pass what some are now proposing, an authorization for the use of military force in the region that would pull back U.S. forces from involvement in Yemen. All this is going to be right up at the front of the agenda of the lame duck in Congress. You might see this in December come up before the Congress, and if it doesn't happen then, almost certainly in the first few months of the new Congress.
Well, Joseph Cirincione, I hope actually I can host you again sometime soon, because I also want to talk about China and India and Pakistan. There's a whole world to lay to waste here, or not, hopefully. But this was excellent. I think this was the tour from Trump and Russia, taking us all the way through the U.S.-UK enabled atrocities in Yemen and everywhere else. So we did a lot of work today, and I hope we can do some more work in the near future.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. I'm sorry if my answers were too long. I am
not
a professor.
At all. No, that was terrific. That was exactly what we dare to be boring here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor.
Pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Joseph. Thank you so much. All right, folks. And actually, I have to admit, maybe I'm just sort of really nerding here, but I didn't find any of that remotely not interesting.
No, that was great.
Fascinating.
Great. Have we had? Have we had him on before?
I feel like. I don't know in this iteration, but it would be shocking if he was never on.
I feel
show.
Like I've written that into a Chiron before, but that was great.
Yeah, Joseph Cirincione's brilliant. All right, folks, we got to go to the fun half. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Subscribe to the show on YouTube and iTunes. Write a review, justcoffee.coop. Check out the News Voice copy on today's show. Tickets are moving fast, so get your tickets to the first Michael Brooks show at the Bell House, February 1st in Gowanus. Matt's going to be there. I'm going to be there. David Grisham is going to be there. There's going to be an Obama impersonation contest. There's going to be a lot of shenanigans. And we're having special guests, of course, Bosch Garsoon-Carr, Luna Minkowski, and T. Trevor Beaulieu of Champagne Sharks. Buy your tickets. Can't wait to see you there. Become a patron of the Michael Brooks Show, patreon.com/TMBS. Stay tuned this weekend. We're going to unlock a large sort of strategic historical overview of the midterms and what to learn from them with the great Bill Fletcher Jr., who everybody should be watching and reading. Matt, Literary Hangover.
Yeah, we're going to be recording tonight, actually. Hope Leslie, Early Times in the Massachusetts, an 1827 novel by Catherine Maria Sedgwick. An early chapter sort of brings up something that I thought has a certain relevance, especially this time of the year, in cultural appropriation. For instance, when a lot of the Pequot women and children were put into bondage in Massachusetts after the Mystic Massacre of the Pequot Indians, they were forced to wear, Puritan-style clothing or English-style clothing, and that was a sign of, you know, it was a sign to, especially the men, Native Americans that were allowed to stay, the Pequot Indians, they couldn't call themselves that after that, by law of the treaty that was signed. It just goes to show that, you know, some people get a bit, impatient with discussions about cultural appropriation, but that stuff is, and that symbology is, that goes back at least hundreds of years, if not longer than that. And there's something
But historicizing it gives its depth, so it isn't just like a, hey, here's a listicle.
Right, it's important
to understand. It gives us the real context of why.
And what it's actually been used to, like, what power it's used to, serve, basically.
Right, absolutely. So, yeah, the IMs are on. We're about to call into the phones, and I feel like I'm forgetting something, but... What's up?
Patreon.com/TheAntifada as well.
Okay, yes. Check out The Antifada as well. Yeah, forget it. There's some other thing, but whatever. We got to keep going. We will see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back, back, back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back. Back.
I'll take all of it you might throw. alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dannerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dannerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks, fucking reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych.
Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. 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 A hell of a lot of bang.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black.
Pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy, total, 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 pussy.